In the words of President George W. Bush, the loss was sudden and terrible, and for their families, the grief was heavy. Our nation shares in your sorrow and in your pride, and today we remember not only one moment of tragedy, but seven lives of great purpose and achievement. To leave behind earth and air and gravity is an ancient dream of humanity. For these seven, it was a dream fulfilled. Each of these astronauts had the daring and discipline required of their calling. Each of them knew that great endeavors are inseparable from great risk. And each of them accepted those risks willingly, even joyfully, in the cause of discovery. These words were spoken at the memorial service of the STS-107 mission, more commonly known as the Columbia disaster.
Welcome to the Current of Emergency Management.
And welcome back to the Current of Emergency Management. Maribel and I are together in the flesh, not recording, virtual, as we have with several of the last episodes, for the first episode of season two.
Hi, Cody. It is good to be back in person. I get to see your face, your smiley face, your quirks. So excited to record in person this time. It's cold January day.
I was giving her a cheese grin as she was saying that for those of you who can't see. So back together in the flesh, we're in a beautiful facility here in Arlington, Texas, at Arlington Fire Department's Office of Emergency Management. We'll get into why we are here in this beautiful facility here in a moment. But today we are going to be talking about the STS-107 mission, which is most commonly known as the Columbia Shuttle disaster, as we are approaching the 20th anniversary of that disaster.
Wow, 20 years. 20 years has flown. I remember I was 23 when this happened in my parents' house, home from college, really watching the incident because two of the astronauts were actually Texas Tech alumni. And just seeing it all unfold was crazy. And I'm excited to interview our guest today. And it's really, really great to be here in the city of Arlington. It'd only be better. Sorry if the Cowboys had won this past weekend, but I had to mention it, but of course they did not.
Well, and you know, I was in the Marine Corps when the disaster started. And I think we'll actually talk about that here in a little bit about the timing of when this disaster happened. And so some of that is an interesting story, but there's so much here. You know, we're excited to be back. I think we posted some great stats for the podcast last year, our first year, and we were in the top 25% of all podcasts.
So can you believe it? Can you believe it?
I know.
Awesome. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, the support's been great. We've gotten some great feedback. This year, we really want to focus on more interviews and really reaching out and just kind of learning from all of y'all as well. So that's the goal this year. As always, we have to throw our standard disclaimer. Maribel and I both work full-time in emergency management. This podcast is not part of our normal job duties, so any opinions are our own and not a reflection of our employer.
But what we can say is Cody does work for a county emergency management office, and then I work more on the regional level.
So with that, today, talking about the Columbia Space Shuttle disaster, this could be its own podcast, I think.
Absolutely.
Especially with this and then going back, if you were to look at the Challenger disaster as well, there's so much here. And we could unpack this all day long, but there's a lot of things that we could talk about. But we have a great opportunity to actually speak to someone whose emergency management career literally started by responding to this disaster. That is Arlington Fire Department OEM Emergency Management Administrator Irish Hancock. Welcome to our show, Irish.
Thank you, Cody. Thank you, Maribel. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here.
Well, I know you're an individual I highly respect. I know you know your stuff, and I did not even know this was actually your first disaster. So in reading your experience from it, I learned a lot about you and kind of how it shaped your career path. So I'm excited to be discussing that with Cody here today.
Thank you.
So let's go back a little bit in history and just talk a little bit about the Columbia STS-107 or the Columbia Space Shuttle. To just give a little bit of background, it's 20 years ago. And so there are probably a lot of people in emergency management today and who are also listening who may not know a lot about it other than maybe it happened. In some cases, may not even know that. So the STS-107 was Columbia's 28th space mission. And if I remember correctly, then it was actually scheduled to be its last. And then upon re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere, the shuttle broke up and that lost communication with Cape Canaveral. The shuttle broke up and it left a massive debris field. And then what followed was a search for the debris for the astronauts themselves. And just ended up being a, you know, kind of a massive search. But, you know, what's interesting, because Maribel, you and I have talked about this. What's very interesting to me is what led up to the actual disaster. And so when the shuttle was taking off initially, a foam block, is the best way to describe it, came dislodged from, I think it was the cranes and stuff that hold it up, but it is where it was. Do you remember all this?
Not too much on the technical portion, but yeah, I know it was a piece of insulation foam that did come off initially.
And apparently that was normal. Mm-hmm. And so this had happened in multiple launches and, you know, just kind of paraphrasing a lot of the research that we've done is it wasn't, no one liked that happened, but it just kind of was what it was. In this instance, reviewing the footage of the launch, one of those foam blocks had struck the wing of the shuttle. And so there was concern on whether or not that did enough damage to create an issue. Obviously, the shuttle made it into space. The astronauts completed their missions on re-entry. The damage that it had done to the wing was enough to allow heat and enormous pressure in on re-entry to cause the wing to break apart. And then what resulted is what a lot of what we'll be talking about today. What's interesting to me is some of the facts that came out afterwards in that it was a known hazard. Several people had raised this within NASA. Apparently even the military had offered to reposition some satellites to maybe take some pictures. And the general consensus was, A, it's probably not a problem. Mm-hmm. And B, even if it is, there's probably nothing we could do about it. And so it just kind of was left unchecked. And then, right, of course, we know the end result. This is why I say we could probably do an entire podcast dedicated mm-hmm. to this and all of the lessons learned. If you go back into the Challenger explosion and some of the issue, you know, if you remember, that was a seal that was bad due to cold weather. A lot of people said this is probably not a good idea. Groupthink kind of took over and said, no, we need to do this, and a lot of political pressure. And so looking at all that, I'm curious, Mira, what is your take? If you take that same thing and apply it to what we do, if you have someone tell you, hey, this might be a problem, we have evidence that this happened, is that something that you think we would say, it might be, but we probably can't do anything about it? I mean, what
do you think? Emergency management, though, right? I know we were talking about this earlier, but I mean, we are there to plan for the worst case scenario. And if you get, you know, some type of intel, something that this could happen, you know, as an emergency manager, you've got to follow that road, right? Investigate it, bring in stakeholders. Is this a problem? Is this not a problem? Let's address it.
Is there something about that that just doesn't sit right with you? It's not just me.
Yeah, and I know there was multiple after action reports done, and I know this particular accident ultimately, correct me if I'm wrong, was the end of NASA space shuttles. You know, they do the space station and work with other private companies now, but really kind of ended the space program for NASA.
It certainly ended the Columbia program. I know after that there was a transition more to there were some Russian mm-hmm. Russian rockets that took people into space, and then now even SpaceX has a, I think it's called Space Elevator program or something, yeah, where they're shuttling people back and forth. But this was the last scheduled Columbia flight. And so I don't want to steer anybody wrong. I don't know if that was the scheduled end of the space program because of the disaster, because this was Columbia's last right. flight. So I'm not a space historian, so I don't want to steer anybody the wrong way, but there was certainly a lot of aftermath that came out of it.
But I know it started, you know, as it came back in reentry, kind of in the Vegas area, right? I started to see a lot of sparks fly. Ultimately, it was over Texas, I think, between Amarillo and Lubbock, where it started to disintegrate and came across the East Texas area and then into Louisiana. And so it was such a large area. I know, Irish, in your article, you have 250 miles long, almost 10 miles wide. So we're looking at size of Rhode Island.
Yeah, and it was about 2.5 million square miles that needed to be searched. And you also have to remember, with this being what was considered a national tragedy, you know, this wasn't too long in the grand scheme of things after 9/11.
Right.
And so there was definitely a push from the White House on down to not only find the human remains of the seven astronauts, but then also find this shuttle, as well as what was the reason. Why? Was it a naturally occurring reason or a man-made reason to why it went down?
And one thing I do want to point out, because when the Columbia disaster is spoken about a lot, it's the disaster itself and lessons learned. I'm all about lessons learned from bad events, but there was a crew of seven people on board. And I think it's important to talk about what they did. And so this was actually a science mission dedicated to the research in physical life and space science. Mm-hmm. It held the Space Hab research double module, involved the execution of 80 separate experiments comprised of hundreds of samples and test points. These seven astronauts aboard worked 24 hours a day in two alternating shifts to complete these 80 experiments. There's a lot of significance to the work that they did. I think in a lot of conversations about this, that's lost, but there was a lot of work. Could you imagine 24-hour shifts, zero gravity?
It's a lot. If
you've never been, I've never been in zero gravity. I would imagine that it takes some adjustment, and it was off to the races. Get up there, start these experiments, along with everything else that they were doing. And so the work that they did was incredible. Unfortunately, I think a lot of that data was lost.
One of the things you were talking about, the science, I remember watching, it was streaming it on, I think it was NASA TV, mm-hmm. Where they had a red team and a blue team. And hence what you're talking about, the 12-hour shifts. And so you could monitor the schedule and actually watch them perform those experiments. And I was, basically nerding out onto the idea that I'm watching something occurring in space live right then. It was pretty neat.
Yeah. And this was, this was 20 years ago. So
yes.
if you're in college and you're 20, then the ability to stream something live or watch something from another part of the world was still fascinating technology back for us 20 years ago. So,
well, I think I told you that I was going to be given the opportunity to meet one of the astronauts when he got back, David Brown. One of my good friends grew up with him, knew him very well, and mm-hmm. set up for Mr. Brown to give us a tour of Johnson Space Center when we got back, behind the scenes tour. Oh. So part of me watching those science experiments being streamed was to kind of catch those glimpses of David performing those experiments so that I could talk to him about it and ask him, mm-hmm. Just kind of have some, for a person I'd never met before, have some type of dialogue about some of his experiences that I saw him do up there. So, I didn't get the opportunity, unfortunately, to meet him, but I think I talked to you about this the other day, Cody. In a weird way, I mourned a person that I never met because I knew I was going to meet him. And so I started looking him up and learning about him. And then I never got that opportunity. It was a very unique experience all the way around.
So Irish, now you are the Emergency Management Administrator here in the city of Arlington. Yes. Again, a lot of special events. You work a lot of big disasters throughout your career. So I think we want to go ahead and segue into, your experience. How did you come to work this specific mission, and how did it help you along your career path and kind of the emergency management aspect to this mission?
Well, it started with going to the University of North Texas to their emergency management program. A plug out for UNT, they were the first EM degree program in the U.S. So that was for you, Mr. Webb. but I really, though, I was going through that program. If you want to just talk about what I should have seen coming in my career, I started September 7, 2001 in the EM program, and 4 days later, 9/11 happened. And so then as I'm about to graduate, this semester I'm graduating, the space shuttle happens. And so two major events occurring in my time in North Texas, I should have been expecting literally all heck to break loose for the next, you know, for the rest of my career. But anyways, part of the requirement was that I had to do an internship. And like most college students, I procrastinated and got down to my last semester and went to the...
That's not normal. Most college students are responsible and on time and do everything when they're supposed to.
Well, then I was the outlier. And
must be what it is, right?
Went groveling to the intern coordinator asking can she, you know, get me an internship so that I could do it and graduate in May. And we're talking, this is late January, early February, or actually it would have been early February. And so,
you're really procrastinating.
I was really procrastinating, like I said. And so, she asked me.
Hold on.
Yes, sir.
Doing quick math. Here, right?
I was squeeze in an internship in a record
that same semester. You graduate.
You went groveling to the intern coordinator in February so that you could graduate in May.
I've grown up a lot.
But this is of the same year, correct?
Correct.
I'm just trying to make sure the facts are straight. So
I just recently had an intern do it in 30 days. So I'm working full time. So
that's what we did an episode on that.
Yeah. True. So I, you know, obviously 20 years ago, I had the same gumption. And that's an old word for you. So, just so happened, and we can call this kismet or fate or whatever you want to say, that my procrastination led me to the space shuttle, because TDEM had asked the program at North Texas if for the first time they were requesting an intern to be part of one of their operations. The problem is you had to drop everything and move out to Lubkin, Texas. And a lot of students weren't able to make that happen. Well, I saw this as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. There was no way I was going to miss this. And so,
and for context, where is Lufkin, Texas?
It is East Texas in the Piney Woods. Roughly, I know someone's going to probably butcher me on this one later, but I want to say 4 to 5 hours away, 4 hours from Denton, longer. But it's not an easy, quick trip. And so I asked,
who aren't familiar, if you know people from Texas, you probably often can be annoyed by our pride of our state, and that's understandable. But if you were to drive from California to Florida, about 60 to 65% of your drive would be Texas. And so when we're talking about, you know, the other side of Texas, I had to move out to East Texas. You know, we're not talking about a state the size of, you know, Rhode Island. For example, you know, you could fit, I don't even know how many Rhode Islands in Texas. You could probably fit several of them in our metroplex. So when he's referring to moving out to East Texas, that's a huge distance in travel.
I just looked it up. From Arlington to Lubkin, it's 170 miles away, and Denton's another 45 minutes to an hour from here. So easily over 200 miles. And one of my favorite stats, Kobe, is from DFW to El Paso. Is the same distance from El Paso to Los Angeles.
Big. We're a big. There's a reason that people from Texas say that we're the biggest and the best state in the union. I'm just repeating what I've said. And for those of you who are in Alaska yelling at the phone right now, if you melt the ice, it doesn't count. We're talking about actual land. So I will face the backlash for that. I love Texas. So I'm sorry. Carry on.
Okay. So, I immediately went to all my professors. They understood. It didn't take much for them to all agree to let me out of the semester. That if I, as long as I showed up to take the final, I made the deal that I would come back at least once during the semester to each one of their classes and give a update as to what I was experiencing and what all I've learned in Lufkin at the disaster field office up to that point. And one class, actually my internship class, she made me write a paper of my experiences, which I've let you Cody mm-hmm. and Maribel read about everything that I experienced when I was there. So for almost 4 months then, I'm just because I want to pick on this one professor, he didn't let me out of it. And so every week I would have to drive back over 4+ hours to attend his 3-hour class.
After working 12, 16 after hours. Working
12, I won't say his name, but I would love to. But I've since worked with him many times after I graduated, and he's a great guy. I just like to pick on him. But
it's such a huge shout out, to UNT for allowing that to happen. What better way to educate, if that's the goal, right? Mm-hmm. Then what better way to achieve that goal than when somebody has an opportunity to do something and then write a paper on it? Are you going to learn something in my class that is more valuable than what you're going to learn in this
living history?
Right.
Well, and that's the way I looked at it. I think in my paper somewhere I wrote it, something along the lines of what took UNT 2 years to teach me about emergency management, I saw in the first 2 weeks at the space shuttle. And then everything after that is brand new and some new experience to add to my career. And I am the first to say that I am in Arlington, Texas, working for the Arlington Fire Department's Office of Emergency Management for the past 17 years because of the space shuttle. It led me down a path that eventually led me to Arlington, and I've been here ever since. So, this was, when I say career defining, it was career defining for me. And then if you really want to look at, how things happen, everybody that I've ever hired to work with me on my team can basically relate it as well, as because of the space shuttle, they got to work for Arlington as well.
Well, and with that too, and again, we have a lot of viewers who aren't from the Metroplex. Arlington is not, if you've never heard of Arlington, then that's, in my opinion, this is Cody talking here, because of the way things are reported a lot of times, then there's some misleading information. And one of those is that where the Dallas Cowboys play football is Arlington, Texas. Where the Rangers play football is Arlington, Texas. Where the
Six Flags
national, where six, yeah, Six Flags over Texas is in Arlington, Texas. What used to be when we were young was Wet n Wild, which is now Hurricane Harbor.
How old are you?
that Arlington, Texas, the National Bowling Hall of Fame.
All the fun stuff's in Arlington, Texas.
is in Arlington, Texas. A lot of times, if you're watching TV and you hear that, you're coming to you live from Dallas, most of the time they're in Arlington.
The World Cup in 2026 World is in Arlington.
You've had Super Bowls here.
We had the 2012 Ice Bowl here, yes.
World Series too, correct?
We did the 2010 and 2011 World Series. Again, I get to be a part of all of that. In a couple of years, they're going to be opening the National Medal of Honor Museum here.
Right.
And
how many state high school football games are played in Arlington, right, Texas?
All of them.
Really, I was going to say, it'd probably be easier to say how many aren't played in Arlington.
And you say it really, this is why you're here. Mm-hmm. But it was, you were just reading your paper and listening to your story. You were really being proactive. You were networking. You were absorbing it all. You weren't just back there on the phone or just filling out a form. You were actively engaged.
Well, again, as Cody so eloquently stated earlier, I waited until the last minute to try and get a job. So I'm sitting in a converted bank building. It was an old bank building that was closed in Lufkin, and they converted it into the disaster field office. So you had one floor of the bank that was for the federal government, FEMA. You had one floor that was for the state agencies, in particular the Texas Division of Emergency Management. NASA had their own floor. EPA had a floor. And so I'm surrounded by lots of agencies who need young, hungry workers. And so as an intern, it's funny as an intern how easily it is to get a meeting with someone when you don't have a hidden agenda. Little did they know I did. And my hidden agenda was to get in front of them and ask them about their experiences and what their agency was doing for the cleanup and the recovery aspect, as well as I wanted to introduce myself to them and try and get a foot in the door. And doing all that. And one fateful day, I was in front of I had set up a meeting with the federal coordinating officer, Scott Wells. And behind him was his deputy FCO, Wayne Fairley. And as a lowly intern, they allowed me to come in and they were going to teach me everything about FEMA. And Scott made the comment at the very end of our discussion as, if I ever need anything, let them know. And I made sure to let them know right then. I think my exact words were, if you're going to ask, then I'm going to go ahead and answer. And I need a job in a few months. And
there you go.
If someone was to hire me, I promise they won't think it was a mistake.
That's a great point. And there's three EMs. We've all been in the head of our office. And so I'm going to ask y'all first before I tell you. Are you more apt to give somebody an opportunity, offer them a job that is very clear and upfront that ask about it, or somebody who's more timid? And the reason I say is that that's a huge value add, in my opinion, of if you're young, you're still in school, you're looking to get into EM, there's nothing wrong with being hungry. Would you tell me what your thoughts are on that? You may disagree.
I had a boss one time when I was interviewing for him. Who asked me a standard interview question, what do you see yourself doing in 5 years? And I told him my answer was, I saw myself sitting in his chair. And his response was that some people would feel threatened by that, but he doesn't want anyone work for him who doesn't want to promote up, because those are going to be the ones who give him 100%. And it's stuck with me, obviously. We're talking 30 plus years later. And it's the truth that that's me. I might have the name Irish, but I'm not that lucky. I like to tell people I make my own luck. And this would be one of those examples. I'm lucky I got to go to do an internship at the space shuttle, but I got hired by FEMA because of the luck I made.
So with that, to develop the timeline, February 1st is when the disaster happened. You said you went to your coordinator in February. So what, from the time of the disaster to the time of you going through the process you just explained, meeting with your professors on the ground with FEMA at the disaster site, how long did that take?
Within 2 weeks, I had nailed everything down so that I could go to look. And so it was shortly after Valentine's Day.
Mid-February.
That I was heading to Lufkin, the city I'd never been in, to do something I've never done before in a career that my family didn't understand what I was doing.
So tell me about that. What did you see? What did you feel based on the kind of all of those senses taken over, showing up there, and everything that you were seeing and experienced? What was that? What was going through your mind? What was that like?
You remember when you were 5 years old and went to kindergarten for the first time?
Yes.
That's how I felt.
Sort of.
I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what I had no real preconceived notions, but I'll also say I had a bunch of pride that I was getting to go do something that was a national moment. The eyes of the nation and the world were on this. And I was getting the opportunity to be a part of it. So I was very excited, but wasn't really sure what to expect. But then also when they were telling me you're going to be in the TDEM's public assistance office, I didn't know what that meant. You know, I didn't know what PA was, much less what it meant and who I was going to be working with or whatever. So everything, I mean it when I say that from day one, everything was brand new to me. My only education or my only experience was my education, what I learned in school with the theories and that had been shared with me, but real practical applications, I didn't have any of that.
So how did you learn? And so Lufkin was one of the base camps, right? There's four different sites.
Well, there was actually, Lufkin was, call it the headquarters, the disaster field office, where all the decision makers were. But then you also had four incident command posts, ICPs. You know, Nacogdoches was one, Hemp Hill was another, Corsicana and Palestine were the four base camps, which was the center of that quadrant, shall you say, of the searching for that area. They had, because of the 250-mile swath that the path of the shuttle, they had to break it up into four areas, and those were the incident command posts for each area.
And they were looking for
everything
right? I read a certain percentage that they expected to get back, and it was a little bit higher.
They ended up, the official, because I had to look this up as well. In my paper, it says 38%, and that's about, or 40% as well, wrote my paper. I've seen anywhere from 38 to 40% of the space shuttle was found. But then, you know, you want to hear stories. A lot of people use that as an opportunity to clean out their fields and yards and reporting. Yeah, I do remember hearing one story about a woman calling in that a piece of the space shuttle fell in her yard, and when they went out there, it was like the hood of a 78 Trans Am or something like that. So
it could have been. Well, and speaking of the disaster, I want to bring up a point. I'm going to quote your paper here. It says, and this was a quote from President Bush. It said, "The basis for my decision," in talking about the declaration of disaster, "to make this declaration pursuant to Section 501B of the Stafford Act includes the fact that the space shuttle and the space program are federal property and federal programs. I therefore declare that such a disaster, such an emergency exists in the state of Texas." And then you go on, this, your words, "the declaration came without a formal request from Texas or Louisiana." And so that's a point that I'll come back to, but then went on to say that FEMA paid, because the president declared the disaster without a request, FEMA paid 100% of the cost instead of the normal 75. When I first read it, it was interesting to me about a federal declaration without the request from the state. And then Maribel and I were actually talking, and I think I was actually talking, Maribel was listening, and I talked I talked myself into going, but the state does that, right? So the governor will declare a disaster for Uri, for example, winter storm that affected the majority of the state. I think we've just renewed a state declaration for wildfire here in the last week or two, drought, right? And so I don't know why that's, even still as I read it, that seems strange to me, a federal declaration
but
without.
This was a national tragedy.
Yeah. 100%. It's just, I think it's so rare.
It is.
That it's strange to think about why it would happen. But then if you really think about it, the state does it for the counties and the counties included in the cities. And so it does make sense. It just seems odd.
Yeah, but like I said, it's a national tragedy because it was another space shuttle that, you know, didn't make it home safely. But then also, I think if you compare it to the time period that was going on, which was less than 24 months from 9/11, I mean, being involved in it and listening to what everybody was saying, it doesn't surprise me it was an instant emergency, you know, declaration.
Right. Now, and so many different resources. And so they had to have involved so many different agencies, right? The FBI, as you were saying, Homeland Security, EPA, there was radiological, or equipment that that was transmitting could transmit radiological, the human component to it. So just so many different agencies that were involved, and I can't even imagine how they began to set some structure to it.
And that was, so mind you, I got there, you know, a couple of weeks after this all started, but they were still trying to figure all that out. Mm-hmm. Initially, right off the bat, who was in charge was the number one question. You're talking about agencies that had never worked together before on a scale of this magnitude in particular. And so it was in the first, you know, day or two, it was real obvious who was in charge. The FBI was in charge to find, you know, Cody, you mentioned some of the science experiments. Well, they had some top secret stuff on there.
Sure.
So it was finding and collecting that, as well as finding the human remains. And the National Guard were the original searchers who were used. They were deployed in the area with the sole purpose to find, you know, hot list items, secret material, as well as above all, the human remains. That was the biggest thing, is to find our heroes and bring them home. And so that was the first 2 weeks of the operation. And to be honest, it's been a while since I read this paper. And Cody, you know, you were just quoting it a little while ago. Something that I totally forgot about was, after the 2 weeks, the reason why the National Guard was demobilized was because they had to get ready for Operation Iraqi Freedom.
That's right.
And they had to be demobed and sent back. And then, you know, the people still in Lufkin, the FEMA and what have you, were like, well, who do we get now? And someone came up with the genius idea of using the Forest Service, because it was the off season for them. And a lot of them were just sitting at home with not much to do. And so then they were mobilized. Another aspect that I totally forgot until I read my paper was that there were, you know, who is in charge. You know, the Forest Service thought they should be in charge because it was in the forest. Texas Forest Service thought they should be in charge. You know, EPA, FEMA, in the end, it was NASA was in charge of the actual investigation, and then FEMA was in charge of the recovery. And so they found a happy balance between.
I think that I think I've said this before, and I'll say it again. I think in almost any incident, especially when you have multiple agencies working together, if we, as a discipline, not only within emergency management, but public safety and any supporting agencies, can get to the point where we stop asking who's in charge and start asking who's in charge of what, then we can be a whole lot better off, because it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, does it matter to get to say you were in charge? Let's work together. But with that point going on, you said over 85 different state and federal agencies.
That is a lot.
My gracious, if you just have the one representative from each agency, it's 85 people arguing about who's in charge.
Well, and think about how many thousands of searchers it took, because they were on 21-day rotations, and we were out there for months.
And this was 20 years ago, so you don't have the GPS units or GIS capabilities that we have today. So, correct. I mean, this is like Garmin type.
Well, you brought up GPS, and so that was one of the things that was, I don't want to say it was new technology, but it was new to be used in this type of a manner, because you had a shuttle fall out of the sky, spread out across 2.5 million square miles, and the rocket scientists, and literally the NASA rocket scientists, are doing algorithms to try and figure out the trajectory of the shuttle coming in, where the pieces would have broken up, what equipment that was on the shuttle was where it was located on the shuttle, and where most likely it could have fallen based on conditions, the environment, the trees, the ground, what have you, and then sending searchers to those areas. And so it was when they would find the pieces of the shuttle. So every search team was had a boss, or, you know, whoever you want to say, that was in charge of carrying the GPS unit. When they would find that piece of material, they would flag it. The person would log it into the GPS unit and bag it, tag it, do whatever they did, and then move on, continue searching the rest of that grid that they were assigned to that day. Collect all the material, take it back to the command post. Then they would upload all the material or all the information from the GPS units to the magical database in the sky. And then those were where FEMA, the GIS groups, were making the maps from that data.
And you said daily maps were posted
daily,
everywhere.
Absolutely daily. That's every amazing. Morning, the old maps from previous day would be taken down and new maps would be put up. You know, I think I have wrote in this paper somewhere that, you know, there were thousands of maps being made daily, which surpasses any other disaster they'd ever done before.
Well, and what something interesting about too about what you said is that the search team leader, or whatever they were called, that Irish is pretty well versed in the incident command system, and so he didn't forget just now what that was called. And I, again, going back to quote your paper, different strategies that were used by different agencies were the federal response plan used by FEMA and the incident command system used by the Forest Service. Those were different. Both structures worked fine for each agency, but working the two together caused complications. Again, if you are new to the EM field, NIMS, the National Response Framework, the Incident Command Structure, we're talking about a time that this was either in its infancy or had not been developed yet.
This was before NIMS.
This was before NIMS.
This was before FEMA was under DHS.
So this is pre, there was an ICS that was in place. It's been in place from the Forest Service. You know, primarily used by the Forest Service pre-NIMS, but the framework for everyone to be able to work together didn't exist. And so at now we would call that a strike team leader, or search team leader, task force leader, division supervisor, whatever the case may be. These were things that only existed in the Forest Service at the time. All of the other agencies that were responding used the system that was specific to their agency.
That's correct. And it was, there was a lot of trial and error on this, trying to figure out, you know, the best search techniques, what algorithm, you know, and I use the example about the rocket scientist and the algorithms. I actually experienced that live, talking to a rocket scientist one time and not knowing he worked for NASA. But he and I were just engaged and just talking about normal mundane things. And then all of a sudden he started kind of daydreaming, looking up at the sky, stopped mid-sentence. And, you know, I had to kind of snap my fingers in front of him. And he was like, oh, sorry about that. I was like, what's going on? Are you okay? And he was like, well, just thinking that if I use this other algorithm, we might be able to determine where the heat shields actually fell based on the trajectory of the shuttle and can narrow the search areas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, idiot me at the time going, what are you, a rocket scientist or what? And he was like, well, actually, yes. And I was just like, okay, I'm out of my league.
Can you imagine the conversations you had? Because and we were talking, you know, during lunch about your experience in programming and just your unique experiences. But like you said, talking to rocket scientists, talking to engineers, being next to astronauts.
That was the most heartbreaking of my entire experience, was remembering that these astronauts, they trained together for years, that these aren't coworkers. Like, the three of us are coworkers, in my opinion. We're professional friends. But to the astronauts, these are brothers and sisters. These are their family. And when the seven went down, they lost seven of their brothers and sisters. And I more than once, I'd seen some of these heroes break down and show their emotions and really effusively thank us for everything we were doing to help them and bring their family home. And that's probably, if there was any overlying theme, is this was a family that needed, you know, to be found.
So where were you having this conversation with this rocket scientist? Where I'm curious where this was happening. I think I know the answer based on some previous stories.
Too, but again, Lufkin, imagine thousands of people descending upon a smaller community in East Texas, and there's not a lot of nightlife. And so, you know, you'd work 12-hour shifts were the norm, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., and then you would go back to your, in my case, I called it the ghetto motel, and with nothing to do, and then we would go to the one bar that everybody went to that was open. And so it wouldn't be, the adult beverage location, and it wasn't uncommon. You would just be sitting at a table with a bunch of strangers. And I can remember clearly one time sitting at one of the tables, and there's an astronaut who had been up in space. There was a rocket scientist for NASA. There was an EPA guy. There was another FEMA person there. And there was a guy who was a Forest Service that had been out searching the fields that day. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that is in my paper, I can't say are from their unofficial official sources. There were people that I just talked to. Yeah. And people that I remembered in the stories, you know, Cody, when you and I were talking about doing this podcast, I think I remember saying that something along the lines of, you can go research any after action you want. But I think where the niche that I feel in all of this is, I was the intern. I was the one that was, I had no experience and everything was brand new to me. I can add context to what, you know, to the facts that were being presented in official documents, because I got to witness it. And really, when you don't know anything, it's amazing when you don't know if something's important or not. So everything's important.
Right. Well, and not only that, your access to information is probably higher in some degrees as an intern, because you're disregarded.
Yeah. And I was the lowly intern, and trust me, John Latham, God rest his soul, he passed away a few years ago, but he enjoyed picking on me, and that was his catchphrase for me, is leave it to the lowly intern to do.
Not only that, you're relatively unknown in an instance like this, where you've got multiple agencies coming together. There's a lot of people who don't know each other.
True.
But But you know, just from sitting back and watching, it doesn't take a lot to figure out who matters to mm-hmm. some degree. And everyone matters. I don't mean that in a negative way, but if you're in a room that has a lot of people from TDEM and Chief Kidd walks in the room, you don't have to know Chief Kidd to know that that's somebody true. Because everybody from TDEM will kind of be around or stand on the, you know, and you kind of see these things. This will happen at commissioner's court when the judge yeah. comes in. I mean, that's not hard to figure out. Nobody's paying the intern respect. Right. And so it's obvious to figure that out. But also, as you said, you went in with no knowledge whatsoever. You correct me if I'm wrong. You don't know if something's wrong. Correct. You don't know if it's being run properly. You don't correct. Know if anything's being followed. So for the most part, you get to just soak everything in with no preconceived notion and file it away. Probably, I would guess, for years, didn't know that some things probably weren't done right or could have been done better.
And you're exactly right. You know, it's been weird for the, you know, the past, since I was reminded recently that the 20 year anniversary is coming up. It's been a flood of emotions and memories, remembering, you know, reading this paper, which brought back a lot of stuff that I just kind of filed away. Also reading this paper reminded me of how little I knew, and some of the stuff that I focus on in the paper, I'm like, well, duh, that's pretty much common knowledge. But at the time I didn't know. And so it's been fun walking down memory lane. And I thank y'all for allowing me to be a part of this podcast with us. Cause it's been kind of fun remembering, and my wife at home is tired of me talking about it. You know, I think she knows more about the space shuttle than I do now, from all my stories to her.
So at some point during the internship, you went working with TDEM to mm-hmm. more FEMA. So how did your role change, and what did you learn from that experience?
Well, as I was mentioning earlier, you know, I was selling myself in these intern interviews. And a couple of days later, after the interview, Wayne Fairley, who was the deputy federal coordinating officer, who was actually the ops branch chief for FEMA Region 6. Again, talk about being an intern. I didn't know any of these terms, much less people. And he just happened to see me a few days after I talked with him and Scott and said, "You're Irish?" I was like, "Yes, sir." His response was, "Well, you're going to come work for FEMA ops when you're done with TDEM." So just wanted you to know, and just walked away. There wasn't a job offer. It wasn't a, "Is this something you want to do?" It was, "You're going to come work for us." And that was it. And so I was with TDEM till they demobed, helped them pack up their vans and leave, which, by the way, TDEM did offer me a job as well. And then as I waved goodbye to the TDEM vans as they drove back to Austin and took off my TDEM shirt, put on my FEMA shirt, and walked right back in, was a FEMA employee then that day.
How did TDEM feel about that?
I was teeing that one up for you. So for those of you from the TDEM days of Jack Cawley, Jack Cawley was the one who made the request. He was the chief of the Texas Division of Emergency Management, and he has since passed away as well. But he was the one who requested the first intern from the University of North Texas EM program. I had been in FEMA, or I had been at the DFO for over a month or two. FEMA had already decided and told me they were going to hire me in ops. And then I got a phone call from a TDEM person that called to say that Jack wanted me to know that there was a position being posted that day, and Jack wanted me to interview for it. Or put in an application, interview, what have you. But you, if you know Jack Cawley, you read between the lines, you know what that call really means. And so, but I had already accepted with FEMA, and I was asked the other day why I chose FEMA over TDEM, and I don't have any clear reasons why. I have theories, and I can save you from those, but, you know, I chose FEMA. And so, telling this person on the phone that I had already accepted a position with FEMA, his response was, "So you're turning down Jack Cawley?" And I clearly remember my response to that was, well, I guess I am. And he's like, all right, I'll let Jack know, and hung up. And, you know, following or not knowing what the future held, I got to see the repercussions of Jack, of turning Jack down. It took several years for Jack to finally turn the corner on me. He held it against me for a bit. I can say with certainty that we got to a good place, because here I am in Arlington, and he was one of my references on my application. I asked him about it, and I think he actually gave me the best reference of anybody I've ever directed to. When Arlington called Jack Colley to ask him about Irish Hancock working for them in the Office of Emergency Management, his response was that it would be the biggest mistake if they didn't. Any other questions?
And I don't know if the title was the same, but he was Chief Kidd. He was the Chief of Emergency Management. He was
Chief Colley. Correct.
And so you left this internship with a job from FEMA, having turned down a job directly from the head of emergency management with TDEM. And I'm just highlighting that point, going back. We've done an episode and talked quite a bit about internships.
Correct.
And the value of internships, and what happens at that internship could potentially stay with you for the rest of your career. And so what I'm hearing from you, I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No, it's okay.
Is that internship not only led you to go from school to a job, but put your career path on a trajectory that led you to where you are now.
Exactly correct.
All because of an internship.
All because of an internship. And, you know, Cody, you and I have, you know, we've talked before, and Maribel as well, about, you know, if you need something, let me know. I have connections, you know, with certain groups or certain agencies. A lot of it is because of the space shuttle, with all the agencies that worked in there, going to work for FEMA. You know, I saw that you, on a previous podcast, had Tony Robinson. I worked with him when I was at FEMA, and I consider him a friend as well as a professional colleague. You know, I kind of went backwards, you know, to get to, instead of, a lot of times you hear people talk about working at the local level and then working up. And I kind of went up and worked my way down. It's been eye-opening going backwards to the local level. You know, being a cog in a giant machine at FEMA, and then being all at FEMA for the city of Arlington. You know, what if you go at the federal level and you're in public assistance there, you're just doing public assistance. Whereas when you come down to the local level, your ops, your public assistance, your mitigation, your everything, you're what an entire agency is, but in one title, you know, for, at the local level.
And for clarity, did you meet Tony during the?
Yes, I had met him when we were in Lufkin, and then I don't want to say I worked directly with him, but FEMA Region 6 is a pretty tight-knit group. There's not nearly as many people working there as you think there might be, being the region for, you know, five states. But you get to know pretty much everybody there. And so I worked with him and seen him and talked to him several times.
But did you meet him in Lufkin at the disaster?
I met him there.
And so then when you went to work for FEMA, being around him, do you remember, and just more my curiosity, what was his job then?
Oh, you would ask me that.
Yeah, going back.
I don't remember.
Honestly. Hopefully we get to interview him again this year, and I'll have to ask about that with his experience. But I was just curious where he was, because I mean, 20 years ago, you know, I would be interested to find that out, where he was then.
I want to say he was recovery, but I can't remember. I don't, and at the, you know, and forgive me, Tony, if you're listening. I don't even think he was the branch chief. I think he might've been deputy, but the thing that I did know about Tony that was very common, and I'm not kissing your tail, by the way, Tony. it was obvious he was a rising star. He was someone that you knew was going to be in charge. So when he became the Region 6 administrator, to me, that was a foregone conclusion years ago. Of course he is.
Right.
So important question, Irish.
Yes.
Did you get an A on your internship?
I absolutely did. on the paper, I did. But you know, the funny thing, when you read my paper, I have quotes in it, but I don't cite anybody. There's no book to cite. It's someone that I talked to or something I read in some document somewhere at the disaster field office.
Well, and going back to your paper and kind of backtracking a little on the number of agencies that were there, When I read this, I really liked it the first time that I read it. And again, quoting the paper, over 82,000 pieces of the shuttle had been recovered and sent to Kennedy Space Center for reconstruction. Many times during my internship at the DFO, I witnessed very polite arguments among the different responding agencies. And by polite, I mean each side was arguing their point, but it was always done with a smile and a pat on the back. This was because the different agencies did not know their own limitations or roles in the search and recovery. Conversely to that point, they also did not know the abilities of the other agencies that they were working with. Disagreements never got out of hand because the agencies had to work together for many more weeks and or months to come so as to solve the puzzle of what happened on February 1st. I feel like that section, that sentence, paragraph, whatever it is, if somebody summed up, why do we go? My wife has asked me this question. She wasn't a question, but recently she told me, I feel like your life is one long meeting. Like you're always in meetings, a year or so into when I first got hired where I am and was getting involved at the COG and on different working groups and committees. And she'd asked me, what are you doing tomorrow? And I said, I'll be down at COG, for a meeting. And she was like, good gosh, do you accomplish anything in these meetings? This is what she asked me. Do you accomplish anything? What are you doing in these meetings that they have to happen so much? And I remember my response to her then, which would probably be the same as somebody asked me that question now. If nothing else, I probably will either meet or have a chance to get to know someone better.
Right.
And I have a better awareness of what everyone, including our region as a whole's capabilities are. If nothing else, the meetings are worth it. It can be a exactly. meeting about the color purple.
Networking and figure out what everybody does. And that's pretty deep observation, Irish, straight out of school. I commend you for that. That's a lot in there.
Well, there was a lot of stress. And I've mentioned this to the two of y'all. The most unique thing about this emergency disaster, whatever you want to call it, was the only disaster I've ever worked where I didn't have stress. I was the intern. Mm-hmm. I didn't have anything, a job other than to push paper. So I wasn't a decision maker. I wasn't directing people. I didn't have a team or a staff. And I didn't have any unrealistic expectations to have to perform to. I just had to do my job, and then that was it. And so I did watch a lot of very tense conversations about people because they were the ones who were dealing with the stress. But again, we're asking people to do the impossible. And they knew there wasn't a choice. They had to. Mm-hmm.
When I first asked my judge about joining the incident management team, he said, I'm not against it, but give me a reason why that I can explain it that makes sense. I thought about that for a second and I said, it gives me the opportunity to train on my job at someone else's disaster. And he said, that's a good reason. I'm fine with it. Go and I bring up that point to just like you said, I had no stress. I got to go. I got to learn. I'm not as familiar with other states, Maribel. You probably have more information about this than me. But mutual aid, especially in our region, is so strong. And if for no other reason, being able to help your neighbor and go and do these things, be a part of regional groups or incident management teams and different things like that, it gives you the opportunity to train. I was telling someone just this morning at a meeting that I think there will be a point in time that EMs who were on the job in 2020, mm-hmm. that there will be a point that having COVID on your resume will put you at the top of any job you apply for, because you got 5-10 years of EM experience in a single year. And then if you survived all of that, then there's a certain level of competence that is expected, that if you did survive, but then the amount of information and things that you learned, for me, that's so valuable to get to be able to learn all of those things, especially if it, you don't have the stress of it being yours. And so if for no other reason why to go mutual aid and help your neighbors and be part of those teams, it's because it makes you better when it's you that's in this, in the hot seat.
True. True. I've often joked that all of us that are still employed in emergency management through or since 2020, that's what we just put on our resume. It's just a bullet point. It just says 2020. And just leave it at that because we all have it. But you make a really good point, Cody. As time goes on and as the next several generations of emergency managers come into the market, there's going to be a smaller group of people who have that 2020 bullet on their resume. So it's a really good point.
Well, and before we get too far from this point, another, Maribel, I agree with you. As an intern, no experience, that it's some really deep insight. As much as I hate giving Irish any credit. But another one that to me really kind of resonated with is when you said that is because different agencies didn't know their own limitations. And I believe it is the International Association of Emergency Managers has one of their code of ethics is that you will not take any job that is beyond your capabilities. You won't take any assignment or job beyond your capabilities. Self-evaluation is so critical. And the reason that I say that is because I think I have theories about the personality type of that are people who make good, effective EMs. And one of those is the lack of ability to say no, not because for really any other reason, is you always want to help. And that can lead you to a place where you think you can solve any problem. You think you can do anything. You think you can take on anything. But self-evaluation of what your abilities are is so important so that you don't get in over your head and you know what's possible. It's easier to, over-deliver if when the request is made, you know that you have those capabilities. And so knowing yourself, knowing your agency, knowing what's possible, in my opinion, is just as important as knowing what hazards exist. Right. Because you quickly know when X happens that this is beyond the capability of what my office can handle. I either need to elevate my activation level. I need to start calling in mutual aid. That's a lot easier to know because you've evaluated your own ability.
Right. And I think that's key is yes, it's important to do self-evaluation. And it's important to know your capabilities and your limitations, but also knowing yourself, you also know who to ask for help and recognize that you are over your head. And that's part of leadership is knowing, getting people to support you and find the additional resources so you don't get there.
Yeah. And I know Josh doesn't, I don't think he listens, but even if he does, I don't care. I'll throw him under the bus. But Josh Roberts, who was one of my mentors, he told me one time, my job's not to know anything except for who to call. He said, but if I'm really good at my job, I don't only know who to call, but I know when to call them. And I remember that. And Molly used to say this all the time. I'm the, I know a guy, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's who I am is I know a guy. And I remember in a conversation with having nothing to do with EM, actually the school administrator where my wife works. And in one conversation, I think three times, and she had asked a question, and I said, "No, I am not familiar with that, but I think I know a guy who would know the answer to that." And then later, I'm like, "Actually, I have a friend who does that kind of work. I'll give him a call." And then I remember hearing Molly in my head going, "I'm the I know a guy, you know." So the value of that, which again goes back to meetings and everything else. So moving on in your paper here, Irish, and this is interesting because I think you and I have talked about this a little bit in the past, but when you say after the FBI and National Guard found the human remains, they were demobilized because of the upcoming Operation Iraqi Freedom. Tell me, and I don't remember all the details, but you were watching the shock and awe from Iraqi Freedom. Is that correct? How did that?
Well, I got to go back a little bit. So, we've already talked about how, the lowly intern gets all the lowly jobs. And after having been there for a couple of weeks, they were finally starting to give days off because it was a 7 day a week operation for a while. So one of the first Sundays that they gave off to the group, well, someone still needed to be there, hence the lowly intern. And so That's actually the day I wrote this paper, is I just sat in there and wrote the whole thing out as I saw it. But there also, that same day, if I remember correctly, was when the actual U.S. invasion was occurring, in shock and awe. Mm-hmm. And I watched it online. I watched it, I think I honestly, if you want side note, I think the reason I was able to watch it streaming online is no one was in the building. So no one was using the bandwidth. But I sat there and watched the invasion occur. I got to see shock and awe. And it was, you know, from my perspective, my memory of it is being shocked that I'm getting to watch a war in real time. You know, this isn't something that was filmed and then put on the news later. This was occurring right that second. And so it was a pretty interesting footnote in the space shuttle, is that all this was occurring during my time there.
I remember when you first told me about that, I was in the Marine Corps at the time. And so for context, that was March 17th, 2003, okay, is when shock and awe occurred. So the space shuttle disaster started on February 1st. And then, you know, fast forward a month and a half later, I was still in the Marine Corps at the time. I was actually on duty that night, and it was company duty, not barracks duty. Barracks duty probably would have been a different story, because you know, kind of do whatever you want. But with company duty, the duty officer is an actual officer, not just an NCO. So you've got to be in uniform and be proper all the time, right? And don't do anything stupid. But that's when shock and awe happened. We were watching it live on CNN. And as you can imagine, as the night went on, the phone started ringing, you know, quite a bit. There were a lot of Marines deployed, had been deployed since the 9/11 attack had happened. One of the largest homecoming of troops in Vietnam was actually since Vietnam was the 26th MU when it finally came home. They were on their way home from a 6-month deployment when 9/11 happened. And a friend of mine who was on the MU said, "We knew something was wrong when communications was shut down, because they killed all communications leaving the ship except for official." And he said, "And the ship started to turn." And he said, "I was able to go out on deck and looked at the fleet, and every ship in the fleet was turning." And that's, and he said, that's how we knew something was wrong. 26 MU was the first Marine unit to put boots on the ground in Afghanistan. And believe it or not, and I would highly recommend, for many reasons, reading his book. General Mattis wrote a book, Call Sign Chaos is the name of it, but that was actually an amphibious assault in Afghanistan. So, you know, the Marine Corps was an amphibious assault force, and that was actually an amphibious assault with the aid of some helicopters and other things taking it. But when they finally got home, I want to say it was around 18 months, if not more, the total gone, largest homecoming of troops in Vietnam. But what was cool to me was, you know, I'd been in the Marine Corps for about 3 years at that point, but I remember distinctly watching that. And then when you were telling me that story the other day, then those memories of me watching shock and awe, and ultimately I was deployed to Iraq as well, but that all started coming back. But what's interesting is, we were talking about the podcast and how this internship was a path to where you are now. Mm-hmm. But I also found it interesting, and I didn't tell you this the other day, is that you and I were watching probably the same or very similar footage of this war unfolding, mm-hmm, at the same time from Texas, mm-hmm, and North Carolina. And then ultimately, we're now sitting in this room, colleagues and friends working in the same field. You know, when 20 years ago we were watching this war unfold, you know, for the first time. And so the path to where you end up is always interesting. I love those stories. And so I didn't share that with you the other day, but that was awesome. My first thought.
Well, Maribel already told us she was 9 years old when that happened.
Yeah, I wish.
On that same
exactly.
Exact day.
I'll go with that.
She was watching Teletubbies. We were watching
Teletubbies.
What were you on? You were working on your seventh degree in 2003.
Yeah, there you go.
What it is?
I was still
school. Which level of school were you in 2003?
The second one. So I was still in my master's, which was interesting because I was coming, I was still kind of in the geophysics world, so the science geeky. But they were sharing information on the sound blast from the shuttle, because they had a lot of seismographs. So the sonic boom was showing up. So I think they were probably contributing some of the science data. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of a different perspective. The Weather Service, the radar, I think I saw some pictures of that, the DFW radar, if I'm not mistaken, with the debris field. So it was a different perspective altogether.
And you said two of the astronauts had ties to Texas Tech, correct?
Yes, they were Texas Tech alumni. And now the Amarillo International Airport is actually named out of her husband, Amarillo International Airport.
Wow.
Because that's where he was from.
I was actually trying to look back, as you said, you were talking about the sound, kind of the sound waves and some of that. And I was trying to remember here, and I'll find it in a minute. I'll come back to it once I find it, the speed that they were traveling. Oh. And the data metric relates that to the number of times the speed of sound. And it's not 3 or 4 times the speed of sound. It was significant. So I'll find that here in my notes.
You imagine? It was being there, and so there was a sit rep situation report that was produced every day, and they had 2 counts on there that was, every day I got the sit rep to see these 2 counts. One was the percentage of human remains that were found, and the other one was the percentage of the shuttle that was found. And so every day, as they were uploading that GPS data and what have you, to watch those counts change more and more. And I found in my paper, the original prediction was only to find 20% of the shuttle, and they found 38%. And so that was pretty monumental task. And Cody, touch on something that you said earlier about the percentage found. That number, we have to remember, pieces were still being found after they stopped searching. As droughts would occur and lakes or ponds would start lowering, they would find other pieces there. I read somewhere, and I apologize, I don't remember, but there's still being calls that are received about or being made about pieces, and whether it is or not, I was sent, one of the errands I was sent on was to go pick up a piece of the material from one of the small jurisdictions in the area that was turned into them, and went to go grab it and did the GPS thing, even though it was at the police station where I picked it up at. It was in a Ziploc bag, and it was probably 2 inch by 2 inch woven material, kind of silver in color. Was that part of the shuttle? Who knows? Yeah. I mean, you don't know.
There was a diverse terrain too. I mean, there was water. I think he said they found other bodies.
They did. I can't say they solved murders, but I do remember hearing that there were, and I don't want to exaggerate and make it sound like there were tons, but there were more than one person found in the woods while they were searching. There's also a funny story about, as the searchers are just jumping fence after fence to go through their grid, and one of the local landowners, farmer, whatever, he had imported some Russian boars. And they took exception to the intrusion into their area, and those searchers got out pretty quickly. But the thing also to remember is when you're talking the diverse terrain, the Toledo Bend Reservoir, they actually had a fishing tournament going on that morning when the space shuttle crashed, and it was really foggy. They heard the booms, but again, they don't know what's going on. And then they started hearing water, things hitting the water all around them. They didn't know what it was. It wasn't raining. They knew that. And in fact, that's how they found the front landing gear was from one of the guys in that fishing tournament who heard the loud splash and directed searchers when they finally, got into that area, and that's where they found it. But you had mentioned, the woods and the diverse terrain. How it looks above ground is the way it looks underwater there. The Toledo Bend Reservoir is actually full of 30-foot forest, underwater there. And so, talking with the dive, I just found this one quote in the paper of the captain of the U.S. Navy dive team told me it was like trying to find something in the forest while blindfolded, as you were suspended from a helicopter, trying to not get your line tangled in the surrounding trees. They couldn't swim out in between all the trees to find debris. And so they would have them tethered to a helicopter, and literally wherever a place was marked to look at, they would drop that diver tethered to the helicopter immediately straight down, let him swim around just that little area. And if they found it, they did. If not, they would pull him up and, you know, go drop him in another area. So that was a lot of the ways. If there was any way possible, any bleeding edge technology that could be used to find any type of shuttle material, I have no doubt in my mind it was used. I know for a fact, when it comes to the air searches, they used everything possible, from NASA's version of a spy plane. I think it was called the ER-2, Russian biplanes, DC-3s, ultralights, several kinds of helicopters, satellite imagery, fixed wing aircraft, motorized paragliders. And this one always makes me laugh. There was a guy, I don't know what they call it, but when you're on a parachute with a fan strapped to your back, he volunteered. Yeah, he volunteered to do it, and they even used a blimp at one point. That was being thought of being used. So, you know, and then when it came to the underwater, every type of sonar that could be thought of that could be used, that could be retrieved safely back, they were trying to use that as well. I was told that one of the things that was kind of hard about the not only the submerged forest, but there was a lot of debris in the water as well. So you couldn't use a metal detector, from the sky to see, because that was either a refrigerator or an old car door or a battery, or it was a piece of the shuttle. And so some of the maps, when you look at all the pieces, when they get over the water, you'll see some dots on the water, but not a whole bunch, because it was too hard to find any material that was found. Most of the, I feel comfortable stating, I don't have this written in my paper, but I would have to say the majority of the stuff that was found was probably found on ground, not underwater.
And I like one of the maps that you showed me. It had, again, a snapshot in time of those maps that were produced every morning and posted. Mm-hmm. But it also listed the amount of personnel at each site.
Correct.
And I did not know that you actually had some search and rescue crews actually lose their lives as well, right?
Yes. So these were an air crew. One of the jobs I had was to sift through a lot of the PIO photos that were being taken. I happened to come across the one photo that was taken of an air crew before they went up. Unfortunately, their helicopter ended up, I can't remember exactly if it hit a tree or a malfunction. I think, in my mind, I think it was a tree, but it crashed and they all didn't make it home. And so, yeah, there were instances of searchers that weren't able to make it home that night. And then you mentioned that map. You have the four base camps or the incident command post, and then you would have 1,000 to 1,500 searchers, Forest Service searchers at each command post. And they're used to sleeping in tents. And so you would see, as far as I could see, tents everywhere. And that was where they lived for those 3 weeks. And then you would have your mobile canteens, the Catholic charities, the Baptist men, HEB, what have you. FEMA purchased all their gear, all their pants, snake guards, boots, socks, everything for them to search. And then fed them pretty well. I was fortunate enough to have a couple of the dinners, and they
weren't MREs.
They weren't eating what I was eating. But
and here's that data point we were talking about earlier, and this is just mind blowing to me. It was at 8:53 a.m. and the shuttle was 231,000 feet above the California coastline, traveling at 23 times the speed of sound, was the first indication of trouble. And then falling debris began to fall on the ground in West Texas near Lubbock at 8:58. California coastline, 231,000 feet above the coastline at 8:53. 5 minutes later, debris was falling on the ground in Lubbock, Texas.
Wow.
It's hard to even imagine something moving that fast. And that's incredible.
Well, another figure that I, going back to the searchers, The 1.5 million man hours spent searching for shuttle debris is equivalent to one person working 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year, for 721 years.
Oh my goodness. That's a lot of people. So I know, Irish, you talked about, you know, how this shaped your career, and, you know, at the moment, same moment in time, Cody was elsewhere, and how that shaped your career. So what advice would you give to perhaps an early EM career professional or an intern starting out at this moment?
When I look back on my career, I would have to say I took chances. I wasn't afraid. Moving out to East Texas to do something I'd never done, that was pretty scary. And you can imagine the people in my life that were, you know, questioning if I was making the right mm-hmm. choice. I can't say at the time if I knew or not that I was making the right choice, but I felt like I needed to take that chance. Leaving there and choosing FEMA over TDEM, you know, I took a chance, you know, hoping that I was making the right choice, but I was going to make it work no matter what. When I came to Arlington, I'll be really honest, I was very nervous taking this job. It seemed above me. Maybe, you know, Cody, you mentioned earlier about maybe taking on more than what your skill set was. I'll be honest, I felt that that's what I was kind of doing. Maybe I was taking on a little too much. But I also knew, to be honest, I was only going to be here for 5 years. I was only coming to Arlington for the Super Bowl. I wanted the Super Bowl on my resume. It didn't take long after that when they started telling me about the next event, and that was coming.
You're hooked.
Yeah, then it was like, well, I want that on my resume. And so, 17 years later, and I'm still here. But, you know, that's a question I've actually been asked by other young EM students or EM mm-hmm. you know, rookies. And I said it earlier, you make your own luck. You know, that Cody, I know you know this one. When it comes down to, the answer is always no if you don't try.
Yeah, I mean, you miss 100% of the opportunities you don't.
That's your 100%. Right.
In the sports world, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. You know, personally, I think there's a balance also between that and did you learn from the shots you missed? Mm-hmm. And so take the shot, but then also learn from, you know, get the lessons for why did you miss? And if not, you don't grow. But I think stepping out and as you said, take a risk. And what's the worst that can happen is you fail. I've never talked to anyone later in their life that has said they regretted trying something. Mm-hmm. I hear a lot of people who regret the things that didn't happen or they mm-hmm. didn't do or things that were left unsaid. I've never really heard a story from somebody who was older who was like, you know, I really went out. I went and tried to start a rock band, and that was a terrible decision. It was, you know, it was always a good story. Yeah, but yeah, back in my rocker days or back, you know, I went and took this job. I think we've talked about this many times, and Irish, you can weigh in on this too. Students always ask the same. There's always one question that an EM student will ask: what can I do to get a job? My first answer is be willing to move. Mm-hmm. If you're willing to move, you can find a job. But a lot of times it's what can I do to make myself more competitive, to find a job where I want, making how much I want in the area that I want to live. And that's really what's behind the question. A lot of times, if you're willing to move, you can find a job.
I would also, though, add to that, because I don't disagree with anything you just said, Cody. But when I reflect upon my career, it also get to know everybody.
Oh, yes.
You know, when I interviewed for this job in Arlington, and I, through my sources, I knew who else they were interviewing. And to be honest, they were people who were more qualified than me. But I knew that there was one thing that I had they didn't have. And when the Arlington interview team asked me, why me over more qualified people? My simple answer was that my Rolodex, that means a phone number or phone mm-hmm. book for you young people. But my Rolodex is bigger than everybody else's. That, you know, I can call FEMA and say, hey, this is Irish. I don't have to introduce myself. I can call Jack at TDEM and say, you know, it's Irish. Mm-hmm. That it, you know, I may not know who I exactly need to call, but I know someone who does know that person. Mm-hmm. And most people don't have the phone book that I have.
Right.
And so taking chances as well as having a network is really what in the field of emergency management can help propel you to the top. Cody, you were talking about, about missing, you never miss 100% of the shots you don't take. Mm-hmm. Did I say that correctly?
You do miss. You miss 100% of the shots that you don't take.
Quoting Jack Cauley, never in doubt, sometimes wrong. You've got to make a decision. You have to make it.
Yes.
Make it. If it's the wrong decision, course correct.
So here we're sitting in the Arlington EOC and I've been staring at the operational planning cycle schedule. And I like the last phase. Execute, evaluate, and revise the plan.
Yep.
So you just revise the plan and go forward.
That's a huge point. I think one of the sayings I learned in class, I don't know if it's accredited to anyone, is that a decision based on 60% of the information is better than no decision.
Exactly right.
But when 80% of the information comes available, don't be afraid to admit you made the wrong decision. It was the right decision with 60% of the information. With 80% of the information, that may have been wrong, and that's where course correct. I like course correct where that comes from. Interestingly, you're off the hook now. You can think Irish, because one of the challenges in a future episode I was going to offer you was if with the biases, I love my cognitive biases.
Yeah, I listened to that one too, Cody.
Yeah. And so I'll challenge both of you. We'll make it fun. Have you ever heard of the planning continuation bias?
This is where I lie and say yes.
Well, but then I'm going to follow up with what is
it? He's going
to
tell us even if we say yes.
Go ahead, Cody.
No guesses or anything?
Planning continuation bias?
Correct.
I'll let Dr. Maribel.
I'm going to be wrong. I was wrong last time. That you just continue to plan.
Plan continuation bias. So not planning. I think that's where you were.
Wait, say that again?
The plan continuation bias.
Plan continuation bias. No, I give up.
It's the tendency to follow the established plan no matter what. And so it's very common and very heavily.
You can't do that in emergency management.
Yeah, but it's very heavily taught in aviation. In aviation, the term is get there-itis. But that's the plan. That's the flight plan. The storm has moved in, but the flight plan is for me to land at that airport. That's what I'm going to do. And what's interesting in reading about it is that the pilot ultimately makes the decision on the approach, whether it's safe or not. And that plane after plane may land when it may be a little unsafe to do so, and that they will continue to follow until one makes the decision to go around and land somewhere else or take a different approach. Almost everyone will fall in line after that. And so the lesson learned from the plan continuation bias is that because it's the plan doesn't mean it's what has to be followed. Course correct.
I think, Cody, I said this to you earlier this week. When having a discussion with someone, one of the things that always gets me ready to respond is when their comment to me is, well, that's the way it's always been. Mm. There's a lot of things that used to be the way it's always been until someone changed them. That's not a argument or excuse that I always accept. So I completely agree.
Am I the only one that just hears nails on a chalkboard? Well, that's just how we do it. That's the thing. So one thing.
I'm an agent of change.
One thing that I want to say, our dedicated listeners who listen to a lot of our episodes know we're beyond what the normal time frame for a typical episode is. One of the reasons we did that and scheduled to record this when we did is we didn't want to put the typical time restraints. And for several reasons, we wanted to be able to talk about the actual disaster itself, but then also draw on the experience from somebody who was there and really take in as much as possible. So this is not an indication of what the length of what our episodes will be here in the future, but we do want to continue this conversation. It is going to be as long as it needs to be, and I'll say that. But one interesting and exciting thing for us in the podcast this year is that we actually have a sponsor for the podcast this season. And so we're going to take a quick break, hear some words from our sponsor, and then we'll be back and be right back at it.
Thank you. This episode of The Current of Emergency Management is sponsored by DragonForce, the command, control, and collaboration platform purpose-built to handle any incident, from ordinary to the extraordinary. Empower your team with DragonForce, the industry-leading multi-purpose platform, providing critical data and voice communication interoperability that enables multiple agencies to collaborate effectively using the smartphones, tablets, and laptops they already own. Streamline your response efforts while interoperating with your local and regional agencies. Use our exclusive discount code CEM for The Current of Emergency Management and save 50% off your initial setup fee. Visit dragonforce.us to schedule a live interactive demo and see how DragonForce can serve your organization today.
And welcome back from that quick break. Going back to Irish, and one of the things I wanted to highlight that you'd spoke right before the break about the search teams and whatnot. So one of the things that, well, two points really with it that were interesting is that the search teams, as you alluded earlier, with if you wanted to drink, you had one option in Lufkin, Texas, but there weren't a lot of hotels and places to stay. So a lot of the search teams were in base camps. And am I understanding this correct, that each camp had between 12 and 1,500 wildland firefighters that were in each camp, or as total?
No, that's at each camp.
At each camp.
Wow. Correct.
And so that's where you gave this fact earlier, 1.5 million man hours. But one of the things I didn't know this, and I found this really interesting, was that the majority of the searchers were actually American Indians.
There were a lot, yes. That was a big chunk of them.
And were they firefighters or?
That was just one of those facts that I picked up. Mm. I was telling you earlier that I didn't know what was important to capture and what wasn't. So I tried to capture everything. And, you know, I kept a notebook and pretty much filled the notebook up. And so that was one of those little tidbits that there is no way that's not important. And so I just wanted to make sure that it was captured somewhere as far as a large majority of the Elmore Native Americans.
That's fascinating. It was 597 20-person fire crews used in the ground search. And so moving on from there, I wanted to ask you, but this is kind of an interesting point. You alluded to it earlier about the GPS global positioning was relatively new for the use. But tell me about the problem that created.
Well, I had mentioned, you know, earlier, and Maribel read from the paper also about how, you know, a lot of the different agencies and groups that were part of this operation had to kind of figure out how to translate their way of searching or operating with who their new partners were to search and operate as well. And one of the instances would be the air crews versus the ground crews. You would have the crews in the air that would see something that needed to be marked and direct a ground crew to go search the area for whatever the object was that was seen from the sky. And so I found it interesting that the air search teams, they recorded their locations in degrees. And the way I have it written down is degrees, comma, degrees. Whereas the ground crews, they use degrees, comma, minutes to log the GPS coordinates. This difference, you know, between the two of these recorded coordinates would cause ground crews to search an area that were different from the area the air crews would want them to search. So wasted time. But it was just, you know, I don't want to say it as a small example. If you were the one being directed to search an area where there was nothing at, you probably thought it was a pretty big example of a miscommunication between the different factions that were all being brought together for a common goal.
Yeah, you think they would have that. I was like, okay, we searched all day yesterday, having that standard. It's like, make sure it's in this format.
Well,
it's a big deal.
But again, though, it's, you know, hindsight being 2020. Yeah. At the moment, there was that phrase. I know you like big words, Cody, ethnocentric. You know, what I believe, everybody must believe. And, you know,
I'm not going to make a comment on that.
But, you know, if you're one of the air crews, you're just thinking that's common knowledge the way others, you know, how else do you get from point A to point B? Right. You know, they just don't think in those terms.
And how many maps point A to point B? I know you read that stat.
That one was that there were thousands of maps being made, but I think the fact that I was talking with you offline is it was at one point it was twice the number of maps that were being printed by GIS than were printed for the World Trade Center disaster.
That's amazing. Amazing number.
Well, and you know, the GPS is, I think, very often taken for granted now because it's common. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I remember the TomTom days, mm-hmm. right? You remember TomTom? Yeah. And
that's how we storm chased.
Is it really? Yeah. TomTom? Everything's done from your phone now. Fun fact, side note, is I was given at a conference for primarily oil field workers, and we were talking about planning and safety. And what they asked me to speak about was planning for accidents in remote areas where you may not have cell coverage. And I was going through the process of the last point of cellular service, right? That's something that if you're in a remote location that you should pay attention to. At what point did you lose cell service? Because it's a whole lot easier when there's a man down, somebody's hurt, for you to know exactly how far you need to backtrack before you can place the 911 call. But then I asked everyone, how are you going to be able to tell them your location? And of course they went through several different options. And I said, well, can you give a GPS when you call? And they said, well, no, we can't get GPS where it is, because how am I going to get the GPS if I don't have cell coverage? And so I'm challenge all of you who are listening, put your phone on airplane mode, pull up your compass and see if it gives you a GPS coordinate. It will. That is a different signal, right, than your cellular data. Cellular data requires for you to hit a repeater. Your cell phone works almost the same way that your radio works. You're hitting a repeater, and you know, from hitting that repeater, then that's how your call is made. You can still find out your GPS location in an LTE denied environment because that's working off the global positioning system. And so there's a lot of things that people don't realize about how GPS works. It's just taken for granted. But if you are in an environment, LTE denied environment, your phone's not working, you're given a new device, something as simple as the format that your GPS location is in could create mass chaos. How many people do you know nowadays can pick up a map and read it? One of the things I hate about modern apps on your phone, map apps, is that they always want to turn based on the direction you're going. I learned to read a map. North is up and south is down, and you don't move your map ever. When you're doing land navigation in the military, you turn your map, you're going to have five NCOs yelling at you. And so it's funny to me that the directional sense is almost being lost because everybody's maps turn. Well, if you have to go back to a paper map, you don't have that luxury. That's to the point that it's a skill. It's not just known. I don't know. That one's fascinating. But it was interesting to read that because I could see the mass confusion of the different formats that you can actually report GPS in. And do either of you know how many different formats there are for GPS?
I do not.
There was three different formats.
I know of three, but somebody's listening going, oh, there's seven, you know, probably so. But no, that was interesting. I'm talking about being able to work together, coordinate that information. GIS wasn't readily available either. I say readily available. It wasn't
in its infancy.
I would say infancy. I mean, you know, the military and other, you know, groups have been using it for years, but you know, being used on the open mass market, that was when it was. It's definitely nothing like it is now, 20 years later.
When talking about ethocentric is a common one that I see all the time. My jurisdiction doesn't have Microsoft Teams. Mm-hmm. We can't afford it. But certain agencies, the larger you are, assumes everybody has Microsoft Teams. Or they assume everybody has ArcGIS, Esri. I don't have ArcGIS. We use a different program. There's no affiliation or sponsorship, but we use a program called Global Mapper. The reason why, I can buy Global Mapper for $1,500 and I own it forever. I can't afford ArcGIS. It's too expensive.
So the next sponsor will be.
But the cost, and it's, to me, it's GIS for dummies. It's much easier to use. I don't have to write code. And so that's what we use. But, you know, a lot of that's born out of necessity. needing to be able to create our own maps locally. But then the assumption is, oh, well, we'll send you ArcGIS. We survey 123, all these different things that I don't have access to. And you don't have teams. You know, and that's kind of oh my gosh, what do you mean you don't have teams? Everybody has teams. A lot fewer jurisdictions have access to those things than you might think.
In my own city, Teams has replaced phone calls.
Ours too.
So if I personally, when I get here in the morning, I turn my computer on, I don't open Teams. But it is amazing how often I get notices through email about someone having sent a message or I missed a phone call through Teams. And I'm like, I have a perfectly good phone sitting right here. Or I have email and I have text. I'm just, you know, I guess this is where someone in the listening audience calls me, okay, boomer. But
I guess at the end of the day, there's so many different types of software. There's so many types, ways to convey information. You just have to be on the same page. And I can't imagine, you know, it was a big federal response, right? And so I'm assuming these are bigger agencies that have ArcGIS, mm-hmm. Have the capability, and all these smaller, I mean, this is rural Texas. They had to adapt, and I'm curious to see if any of the EOCs were involved and how they integrated into the bigger picture.
Well, I mentioned to you earlier, Maribel, about, again, being the lowly intern. The difference between calling a county judge in a rural part of mm-hmm. East Texas versus had I been in a major metropolitan metroplex. If I needed to get in touch with the county judge for Tarrant County or Collin County or what have you, Dallas County, I probably would have had to make several messages or leave mm-hmm. several messages, make several phone calls. Whereas in East Texas, where one of my jobs when I was doing this was to get counties to sign mutual aids that didn't have established mutual aids. FEMA had come up with a one-page quick MA mm-hmm. document that would be approved. And so I would call these county judges. And I would just have some random numbers to call, ask for Bob, the county judge. And it was amazing how often they would put them right on the phone to talk to the lowly intern. And then I would fax them this one-page document, and I would have it back within an hour, 30 minutes, just signed, versus the metropolitan uh-huh. counties would have to run it through legal and discuss it and what have you. There was a lot of times I just got, you know, just on the fly agreements from the county judges with little to no pushback.
That's nice.
And then later on that evening at the bar, you were like, you're the person I was talking to.
You make it sound like I went to the bar all the time, only most of the time.
Right. I know you a little bit. I know you a little bit.
There was not a lot to do in Lufkin, Texas.
I can imagine.
And thankfully, this was, I say thankfully, but this was before the days of Facebook, before the days of mm-hmm. social media, Twitter. Can you imagine that incident happened today? The amount of more information that you
do have. You want to know the first cell phone I ever had? I got it for the space shuttle.
Did you really?
Yes.
I'm trying to remember 20 to 20 years ago.
Oh, Nokia. I think I had a Motorola at that point.
I do remember, flip ones. And it was in the Marine Corps, and some of the people I was stationed with had got, you know, these phones that'll take pictures and do all this stuff. And to me, that was just ludicrous. If I want to take pictures, I'll buy a camera. And when I had to buy a phone that had a camera, I was so mad that it had a camera on it. But it was the only flip phone that they had available, and I wanted it to be in my pocket because it's a phone. And then people started using flip phones to text. Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. They would like punch 123, 123. And I'm going, what are you doing? Call her. Like, why are you going through all of this? Just pick up, like, hit
and look
send.
How far he's gone. He's been texting and taking pictures like, during this podcast.
You're one of the biggest technology nerds I know.
It's fun. That's fun. Talk about the path that changes things. What sold me on the smartphone, I remember, I was a holdout. I used to be a strength and conditioning coach, and I was on getting ready for a long bus trip with one of the teams, and wanted to be able to have something to do. And so I bought an iPod Touch, mm-mm. which was basically the precursor to the iPhone. And so it looked just like an iPhone. It basically did everything that an iPhone did, except for it didn't make phone calls, but it let you put apps on it. And so I'm like, oh, that's perfect. And buy one of these, download a couple of movies on it. I'll have some movies to watch and different things. And then when I bought it, that was like, I don't have to carry my phone and this.
Okay. So, but then it was still pretty much, it's always, for me, it's always Apple, no sponsorship there. But it was always an Apple product because it was easy, right? Just buy a new one.
If you talk about people punching their dashboards right now,
mm-hmm.
all those Android all people those Android. Are quite upset at you at the moment.
Well, I proudly say I use Apple products for the most part because I just want them to work. I don't want a lot of.
Oh, wow. And again.
Here we go.
Wait a
here
second.
But if you think you want
more about the shuttle?
Yeah.
The Android users like all of the things you can do. You can change this, put different SIM cards. I just want it to work.
Oh, but, okay. We're going to go back.
But then moving on.
Real Cody back in.
That is going to be, I'm going to start a war here in the Android. But
the woke culture just
really my dive into technology was because of this job. And so I learned very quickly, staffing is not going to be something that's easily available for me. And so I had to figure out ways to optimize workflows using technology. And so then, and that's really the path. And so a lot of everything I know, you know, from a technical standpoint, and even the audio, I knew nothing about audio before 2020, but we had to stream Commissioner's Court and we had to do that in a way that the sound was some. So I think I've said it on here before, but I've made the joke several times. I got a master's in audio visual from the University of YouTube, and my professors were gamers because gamers love getting on and making videos about all their gear and everything. And so that's how I learned. And I've found technology quite interesting since then. So learning more about it, but all that to say, reining it back in. Hopefully if you're an Android user, you've calmed down. I'm sorry. I don't have anything against
Android.
He's
going to edit that out, right?
I just don't use it. That
we're looking for new sponsors.
That one's saying. I use some Android products. Our duty phone. So I'm sorry. I didn't mean to offend anyone.
But no, Irish, we really appreciate you coming and talk or allowing us to come here into your home and talk to us today about your experiences. I know I learned a lot, and I know at the end of the day, y'all were there to bring, you know, the 7 astronauts back home, peace to the family, unfortunate situation. And do you have anything else to add to that?
Well, we've mentioned, you know, the 20-year anniversary. We mentioned the 7 who were unable to come home. But the one thing we haven't done to this point is actually mention who the 7 were. So if you will humor me, I think it's appropriate to actually say their names and Absolutely. What they did. So STS-107 was made up of 7 astronauts. The mission commander was Rick Husband. The pilot was William Willie McCool. Mission specialists were Kalpana Chawla, David Brown, and Laurel Clark. The payload commander was Michael Anderson, and the payload specialist was Ian Ramon. I just wanted to say that and thank y'all. And another fun note, Kalpana Chawla, just a shout out for the city of Arlington and UTA. She went to the University of Texas at Arlington. They actually have a statue and a building named after her, and I think that's very well deserved.
Absolutely.
So thank
Absolutely.
You.
Interesting about that, because I talked about Texas earlier, but you said 2 of the astronauts were alums from Texas Tech, and then we, I'm sorry, I don't want to butcher it. Say your name again for me, please, Iris.
Kalpana Chawla.
Is an alum here at UTA. It's 3 of the 7 were alums here in Texas. So, and then this is primarily where the debris field and the disaster was. And so very much hit home. One thing that I think is important beyond researching the disaster and the lessons learned is that this is part of our history here in Texas. It was a very significant part of our history. And if nothing else, one of the things I appreciate, Irish, about you taking the time to talk to us and explain that 20-year anniversary. There are a lot of people who are probably in the EM, entering the EM world or still in school who weren't alive.
That's true. You're making us feel
sorry,
old.
You took a really good moment there. And then.
But that's important because beyond the lessons learned and everything that happened is that this is part of our history. And I'm glad you read those names. That's another thing we don't need to forget. Mm-hmm. And always remember when we are researching these kind of things, we want to learn the lessons, but there were people involved. And that matters.
My team here in Arlington, they get tired of me. You know, I feel like the old man in a rocking chair on the front porch, serving them, you know, lemonade, you know, spinning yarns about years gone past. But I do agree with you. The field of emergency management for the past two decades plus has really expanded from what it was prior to the new millennium. And it's instances such as 9/11, such as the space shuttle, and you can just keep naming the big ones that have come since then that has really made our field what it is. There's, especially after COVID, there's been a lot of in our field who historical knowledge has left the field.
Right.
And it's important that the knowledge be captured in some manner because, you know, and Cody, you keep making me point to you about phrases that are said, but if you don't learn from the past, you're doomed to repeat it.
Absolutely. I mean, history is, and I'm not going to get political with any of this, history matters. And the bad things in history matter. The good things in history matter. The story, I remember a couple of weeks ago, we took Mattis camping, so I didn't have any of his books, and he wanted a bedtime story. And of course, I didn't have a book, so what am I going to do? And I'm like, well, I'm not very creative. That's not where my creativity comes from. And so I said, how about I just tell you a story? And he was like, okay, story will work. I said, the cool thing is this is true. This is a real story. Let me tell you the story about the War of 1812, the Battle of New Orleans, Andrew Jackson, the Battle of New Orleans. And I said, why y'all are laughing. And I'm telling this story about the Andrew Jackson was told by his scouts that the British were setting up camp, and he was so infuriated by this, he slammed his sword into a table and said, by the eternal, they will not sleep in our land. And he ordered his troops to march. Of course, he's getting into it because I'm being animated. And he ordered his troops to march on the British, who hadn't fortified their position because they didn't take the American army seriously, and just decimated them. And what I didn't get into with him is the value of that story. It's so rich because, one, the British didn't take Andrew Jackson and his army seriously. They paid dearly for that. Two, it was useless. That's what is often lost when our history isn't taught to its extent. We had agreed to what the war was over, which was the enslavement of American merchant marines who were being captured at sea and forced into British service. That's what the war was essentially over. That practice ended before the Battle of New Orleans was fought. But you can't pick up a phone in 1812 and call them and say, hey, we're good. So we ended the. Actually, the war itself, the British Parliament had outlawed the practice prior to us actually going to war, but the Americans didn't know that yet. We were tired of it. What a lot of people.
I think we were reeling, Cody. Yeah.
I was like, so Maribel, what he didn't say was the very next night he told his son the story about Vietnam.
Oh. I talked to that story, but interesting fun fact, if you ever looked at the history of where our national anthem comes from. Putting y'all on the spot.
Dr. Maribel?
No, I don't know.
War of 1812, Battle of Baltimore.
Your poor son's going to get beaten up on.
Oh, he's loving it. He's going to love it.
When he spouts off these facts.
But the point of all of that is the history matters, and where things come from matters. And, you know, the point is to take what has been learned and not make those mistakes, build on that, continue that body of knowledge, regardless of what the field is.
I think that's where you were going with that.
Yes, absolutely. I do agree with that.
100%.
No, I'm afraid to say anything else you're going to tell.
I'm not. Yeah, but.
So you wanted to read an expert from the final lines from Irish's paper.
I did.
So, Irish 20 years ago. Who's reading it? Is it Irish or Cody?
I want to read this one.
All right.
So this is actually the closing of Irish's paper, and this will be the closing of the podcast. I want to thank all of you for listening. 20-year anniversary, February 1st. This will probably be posted before the anniversary, but within a couple of days. But that's why we did it now, is we wanted to honor the 20-year anniversary. And so I want to close with with the end of your paper, because I think it's very significant in terms of our profession. And I think both of you would agree, we don't ever want the bad thing to happen, whatever it is that we're working. But if you remove what that is, you have to enjoy your work in order to continue in this profession. Is that, would you say that's accurate?
100% accurate. Mm-hmm. Is this the point where I say before you read it that pre-NIMS, a disaster field office, DFO, was the name of the facility where the federal agencies were at, whereas now I think if I remember right, it's a JFO, the Joint Field Office.
That's right. So, and that term will come up here, but in closing, reading with this, we have to be able to enjoy our work, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think that I've heard some conversations, not widely spread, that there's something wrong if you enjoy the disaster. Well, I don't enjoy that bad things happen, but we can enjoy the work that we're doing. And so I'll close with this, and this is Irish's words. There is a term that I've heard around the DFO that I think sums up how I feel. I have become a, quote, disaster junkie. This is the first job I've ever had where I feel good every day when I go home. What I am doing is important to the greater good, not just helping some nameless, faceless corporate giant increase their bottom line to maximize profits. I want to go where there is a need for help and know when I leave that what I did, the long hours I worked, the decisions I made mattered. I want to be in the thick of things and feel rewarded when the day is done. I want to save the world and feel good about it when I'm done. Hello, my name is Irish Hancock, and I'm a disaster junkie.